This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're going to listen back to a conversation I held last week with Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He's represented his Chicago district in Congress since 1993, but his personal story and leadership on immigration reform have elevated him to national status. His new book, Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill, outlines that personal story. We talked in front of a packed gallery at Real Artways in Hartford. Before the event began, he was signing copies of his book and talking with a large crowd of people who see him as a kind of rock star of immigrant rights. Like many immigrants to America, Gutierrez grew up in two worlds, but always as an American citizen. He was raised in Chicago in the 1960s, but his family moved him as a teenager to a small town in Puerto Rico, where the verbal and streetwise Chicago kid was targeted as a quiet outsider. During the conversation, he talked about his battles with the Obama administration over deportations and his outsider role in the Congress. But we started with his life growing up in Chicago.
My mom and dad come to New York City. It's 1952. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans are leaving the island during that decade. It's after World War II. There are no jobs. There's really no future for them on the island of Puerto Rico. So you have this huge migration. And so they don't come as immigrants in the classic sense because they're citizens of the United States, but they do come as migrants in the classic sense. I mean, we're here in Connecticut. In Connecticut, they didn't come simply to work in factories and wash dishes. They also came to work the fields and to work agriculture here, as they did in much of the Northeast. And so my mom and dad, they get to New York City. It's 1952, and what are they received with banner headlines that say, you know, Puerto Ricans bringing tropical diseases, how can we control them? Almost a reflection of New York Times editorial opinion in 1910 about how can we control Italians coming to the city of New York, except they weren't bringing tropical diseases. That they were bringing, you know, poverty, that they were bringing a new welfare state, that they were bringing criminality. Kind of like the Irish in the 1850s as they arrived in New York City. So in that sense, my parents arrive and I arrive, it's 10 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1963. So I grew up in a city of Chicago where there might not have been signs that said whites only, but we knew better than to go to that swimming pool. We knew better than to go to that restaurant. We knew better than to venture into that neighborhood.
You were very aware that you were Puerto Rican in Chicago.
Very. It was impossible not to be, right? I mean, I never quite understood the police as being officer friendly in terms of my life, right? Because police and the relationship that they had with Puerto Rican youth, we were always suspect to them, right? It wasn't a relationship where you would call upon them for friendship. So, yeah, being called spick, being called Puerto Rican. I mean, just about every Puerto Rican can relate to you a story in their life when there might be conflict, and this person simply says, oh, why don't you go back where you came from? Well, where are we going to go back to? Am I supposed to go back to 849 West Willow in Chicago? Am I supposed to go back to Puerto Rico, which has been part of the United States since the Spanish-American War, and Puerto Ricans have been citizens since 1917? So that's, but I also want to relate that my mom and dad, they spoke to me exclusively in Spanish. Kind of like Italian immigrants probably speaking to their kids exclusively in Italian and German and every other immigrant group. And I spoke to them only in English. And we understood each other perfectly in this bilingual household. And so that's the city of Chicago that I grew in. I grew up in the city of Chicago. I still remember, even being a little kid, not only the election of John F. Kennedy, but the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the impact it had in my family. I mean, in our kitchen wall, we had a picture of Jesus Christ and a picture of John F. Kennedy, the first Catholic president of the United States. I remember the joy that my parents felt when that happened. I remember the extreme sadness, not only that all of America felt, but I remember the extreme sadness that my parents felt. That was the city of Chicago that I grew in. So one year my name was Gutierrez, Gutierrez. You know, I mean, depending on how the school teacher would decide that year to pronounce, I'm not saying it was anything mean or malicious to it. It just was it was what it was. And that's the city that I grew up in, listening to the Beatles and the music and being part of the 60s. I lived a few blocks away from Well Street, where all of the hippies were at and everything was psychedelic. And it was the 60s. And that's when I am 15 years old and my adolescence begin, and so does my childhood change.
So as much as Chicago was a place where, in a way, you were an outsider because people would say, you know, go back to where you came from. That was your home. You were a Chicagoan, but then your family decides to move to Puerto Rico. It's a place you'd never lived. Why did they decide to move, and what did this do to you to be torn from this city to go to this island you'd never really been?
I got to tell you, when my mom and dad, they bought French provincial furniture. Why? Because that's what they bought, dark, ornate furniture. And I still remember them saying, don't sit on it till the plastics get here or you'll destroy it. And they bought a new stereo and they bought a new car. And they brought new things, right? A new refrigerator, a stove. You would think all of these things existed in Puerto Rico. But you see, my mom and dad weren't going to return as poor as they left. They were going to return with good things that they had achieved and a sign of their accomplishment in the United States of America, of their many hard years of working and toiling here. And their dream was always to return home. It's a constant theme in the Puerto Rican community, ¿verdad? Quiero regresar a la patria. I want to return to the fatherland. My mom would always say, if she saw a lot of gangbangers on the corner, she'd say, esta no es mi tierra. This is not my land. When it snowed a lot, and she said, God, how am I going to get to work? Esta no es mi tierra. When all that snow was there. When we came home and all our cupboards were open and the rice was strewn on the floor and the sugar and everything of value had been stolen, esta no es mi tierra. You know, I grew up in a household where you had four American citizens, right? My sister and I, and my mom always wanting to return to what? To her land. Well, when I was 15 in 1969, they finally did. But when we got off the airplane, I remember that Pan Am flight. Getting on an airplane was fun and going to Puerto Rico. And I said, well, maybe this little gig of going to Puerto Rico is not going to be so bad. This certainly seems like fun. Maybe the rest of the journey will be the same. But I knew it was going to be different when we got off that airplane. Because I turned around to my dad as I felt the tropical heat for the first time of Puerto Rico. And I said, Dad, can you buy me a Coca-Cola? I'm thirsty. And he looked down at me and said, Hijo, estamos en Puerto Rico. Aquí se habla inglés. Aquí se habla español. My son, we're in Puerto Rico. You have to speak Spanish here. And I kind of said, why? He said, porque la gente se van a creer que tú eres mejor que ellos. Aquí se habla español. People will think you're better than they are. In other words, you'll be arrogant. You speak Spanish here. And I kind of thought, like a 15-year-old, you know, you've had this plan for 15 years to come back to this place, right? This is your dream, right? I left the only home I've ever known. You're returning to the home you've always wanted to. At least you could have let me in on the language issue here. And maybe, you know, help me out here. So what is it? I write about, you know, in Chicago, many times, I was treated like I was too Puerto Rican to be American.
Yeah.
And when I got to Puerto Rico, I was treated like I was too American to be Puerto Rican. And the kids made fun of my language, and they ridiculed me, and they belittled me, and they rejected me. They thought I was one of the sharks from West Side Story, except I had white sneakers and not black ones. So I couldn't quite understand. But it was a very difficult time. Adolescencia, right? Adolescence. I always thought that adolescencia era la ciencia del dolor, the science of pain. Now, the reason was because adolescence was a very painful time. Just so that everybody know, those aren't the two words that make up adolescence. Okay, I don't want anybody to get confused, but I always thought it was. So now I'm in Puerto Rico. I thought I would return. Everybody told me I was Puerto Rican in Chicago. Yet, when I'm in Puerto Rico, what do they call me? El gringo. El americanito. And I kept looking at myself in the mirror, and I said, no, the only time I've been white was when that birth certificate was issued. Because in December 10, 1953, when they issued my birth certificate, I went to go check it to write the book to see what it said. And under race, it said white. I said, well, that must have been the only day anybody ever thought that of me, the day I was born. Because I certainly wasn't treated that way in terms of a segregated city. And a city in which yet the civil rights movement and the Voting Rights Act had yet to be adopted in this nation.
And this wasn't moving from the city of Chicago to the city of San Juan. This is going out into the hills. And so this is a very, very different place for you in a lot of ways. There's a whole chapter of the book where you start to, I think, find yourself, and you write about winning an English contest. It's the place in your story where I feel like after you come from Chicago to Puerto Rico, you finally get a little bit of the fire in you that stays in you throughout the rest of your life. Can you just briefly tell us that story and that turning point in your life?
Well, first of all, understand this, that when I registered for my sophomore year of high school, the teacher asked me why I didn't know my complete name, and I relate that story, because I didn't know my mother's maiden name. And I remember he asked me, ¿Tú no tienes madre? Don't you have a mother? And I thought about the playground kind of, you know, kidding that goes back and forth, and you never made fun of anybody's mom. And I went home crying that day, and I said, Mom, you know, I don't know my name, and I can't register for school if I don't know my name, because something about it, yo no tengo madre, but I know I have one. You're my mother. And I learned that day my name, Luis Vicente Gutierrez Olmedo. Luis Vicente Gutierrez Olmedo. Just realize I'm 15 years old, and I'm finally learning my name.
Something else your parents probably should have told you.
Maybe they should have let me out. They were good with Gutierrez, 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 whatever it was. But my point is, I went back to school the next day thinking I now know my name. And I walked up to a girl in the corner of the room, and I said, Hola, mi nombre es Luis Vicente Gutierrez Olmedo. ¿Y cómo tú te llamas? And what's your name? And she raised her hand frantically, right? Mister, mister, that's what they call the teachers in Puerto Rico. Missy and mister. Mister, mister, mister. And the teacher says, yes, what is it, young lady? El gringo me está molestando. So I had to put that into some context. But I want everybody to, I'm happy you laugh because I laugh too. But I want you to understand that when you're 15 years old and everyone in your classroom is laughing at you, and laughing about you, I want you to feel that you want the earth to simply suck you up. How painful it is, how isolated, how alienated you feel from everything else, how distant you feel. And it's like a rejection. And where do you, I mean, you're 15 years old, you're lost in this new culture with new idiosyncrasies. And you're not quite understanding why you're not being accepted. You're being treated as a foreigner in your own land. So now we have the English. There's an English contest. Every year there's English Day. And everybody gets to, you know, do English Day. I said, well, I'm going to show everybody now. You can make fun of my Spanish. But guess what? You all learn English as a second language. You know, rolling R's, well, we'll see how you roll some of the words in the Gettysburg Address. And so I chose the Gettysburg Address because obviously I was from the land of Lincoln, right? From Illinois. And plus, it was only 300 words or less.
It's a so pretty it good pretty, one. Yeah.
It's a pretty easy speech to remember. And I remember reciting it before everybody, and everybody looking and saying, man, this gringo can speak English. And saying, yes, there is something I can do. So it was kind of the first time, yeah, your Spanish may be a lot better than mine is, but my English is a lot better than yours. And what I wanted to show everybody in that English Day was I was smart too, that I had talent too, that I had ability too, and maybe you could recognize that ability. And before we move on, I just want to say that as I write the book, I want to say that there are millions of immigrants that come to this country that live in this country today undocumented. And they feel rejected and they feel scoffed at. And you know, sometimes you hear on the radio, especially on right-wing radio, how they're criminals, how they're here to get welfare, how they're bringing diseases even to this country, and how they come here to corrupt our society. You know what? They were wrong about my mom and my dad when they came in the 50s. They're wrong about the immigrants today. And I kind of feel sometimes that I'm a product of the civil rights movement. You know, people gave up their lives so that we could have a Voting Rights Act, so that one day I could serve in the Congress of the United States. Without the Voting Rights Act, there is no 4th Congressional District. Therefore, there is no Congressman Luis Gutierrez. And I want to give honor to all of those that gave up their lives and sacrificed so much so that I could have a voice. And I also want to give a voice where there wasn't one for my mom and my dad 60 years ago. To the voice of the new immigrants that live in this country today.
You're listening to Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez. We spoke at Real Artways last week. His new book is called Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. Coming up, he'll talk more about his life in politics, his relationship with President Obama, and his ideas about comprehensive immigration reform. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're listening back to a conversation I had last week with Congressman Luis Gutierrez in front of a live audience at Real Artways in Hartford. Gutierrez has represented his Chicago district in Congress since 1993, but his leadership on immigration reform has elevated him to national status. His new book is called Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill, and it outlines his personal story. The book starts with a tale about the real beginning of his career in politics. He was a homeowner in his hometown of Chicago, and he talks about strong-armed city Democrats, his defiance, and a fire.
In 1983, there was a congressman. His name was Harold Washington. He ran for mayor. He won the nomination, the Democratic Party nomination for mayor of the city of Chicago in 1983. He was the first black man to win the nomination. And he would become the first black man to be mayor of the city of Chicago. And when Dan Rostenkowski, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, a counselor to Democratic president, sent his precinct captains to my house to ask me to put up a poster that said Bernard Epton, before it's too late, the Republican nominee, I had had enough of watching this old house and, you know, stripping the floor and maybe stripping a piece of cabinetry and building my house and having a six-pack on the weekends and playing a game of dominoes and watching Robin Williams, the crazy guy on Mork and Mindy. I'm dating myself, but that's my life, right? I knew that my life had to be more. And I got very angry and incensed when I saw that very overt racism. The white Democratic Party establishment, yes, Democratic Party establishment, was against Harold Washington because he was black, because he had won the nomination. How else could you come up with a theme before it's too late? And how is it that they all were Democrats until the day he won the nomination? And then they called it Beirut on the Lake. Well, I went out and talked to all of my neighbors for Harold Washington, and he won. The next year, I ran against Dan Rostenkowski, the powerful chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the counselor to presidents. I used to call him a paper tiger. I thought he was a paper tiger until election day when I only got 24% of the vote. But anyways, the story is Harold Washington was great. He invited me and other young people like me to come and become part of his administration to give us an opportunity. Because how is it that Luis Gutierrez is here today if Harold Washington, the mayor of the city of Chicago, doesn't see something in me and gives me an opportunity to come and understand government and to work in government? Well, in October, a few months after the election against Dan Rostenkowski and a few months after I started, on an October Indian summer night, a brick comes crashing through my window, and following the brick is a gallon of gasoline. And that's the Ring of Fire, the first chapter in the book. Violence is unfortunately part of political struggles for justice and for fairness and for equality. Sometimes when you demand it, that's the kind of reaction. But I want everybody in the audience to understand something. Soraida, my wife and I, we have forgiven long ago the people who tried to kill us that night, the people who burned down our house. We hope that they found peace in their life. We found a lot of peace in our life. And that moment defined for my wife and for me, our future. Number one, we could say this is very threatening and very dangerous and move away from it and go back to our very comfortable lives. We were both college graduates. We had a lot before us. Or we could make a recommitment to public life and a vocation to public policy. We decided, obviously, the latter. I'm happy we did. But I want people to understand that many, not only me, but I express my story so that others can understand that these are the kinds of challenges that movements for social justice confront. They confront violence. And what you have to say to violence is no, that you are going to persevere and you're not going to be intimidated into stopping a fight for justice and for freedom here in this country.
Once you came to Congress, you continued to fight, and you didn't make a whole lot of friends in Congress right away. And throughout your career, it seems as though you've alienated some who are very comfortable in Washington. As we move our conversation to talking about this idea of some sort of comprehensive immigration reform in America, I guess I'm wondering how you feel that part of your career has played out. This idea that sometimes you need to play the game in Washington in order to get things done versus seemingly, Luis Gutierrez, the way you've done things, which is you stand up for what you want, you continue to fight for it, and then you slowly turn things to your direction. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about that in the context of this fight for immigration reform, because there's a lot of ways to get things done in Washington, and yours is the idiosyncratic way.
Yeah. When I first got to Congress, I still remember, Clinton. I had campaigned for President Bill Clinton, and I was looking for myself, right? I was looking for my space in the Congress of the United States. And it was a time, if you remember, of 93 and 94 and 95, that the Congress was alienated from the people. We had special parking spaces. When you got to National Airport, it says reserved for member of Congress. There were elevators reserved for us, entrances reserved for us. Everything was about. I remember sitting with Speaker Foley and having lunch with him. And I just want you to think about this. It is 1993, and they had fine china and linen, and I'm going to go have, as a member of Congress, freshly minted, to have lunch with the Speaker of the House. And they had three black men with white gloves and bow ties on, serving us. And I said to myself, there's just something wrong with this picture. And so that's the Congress that I got to, and I wanted to change that Congress. I later found in my constituency that people kept coming to me telling me they had problems with immigration, that they wanted to be citizens, that they wanted to bring their moms and their dads, that they wanted to reunify their families. So I said, you know what? I'm going to leave the reform stuff to one side, and I'm going to pick up a much more human reform side. And the reform side that I picked up is the reform for the immigrants of the United States and a fairer, more just system for them. And I've had to fight a lot of people in that reform. I want to say this. When I first started out, there were a lot of press conferences and nobody showed up. I know we're being successful because if I call for a press conference at 12 o'clock and it's 12:01, the people I invite have already started the press conference in my absence. Now, that's a good thing in politics when there are many people imitating and assuming the positions that you have strived for. And in some occasions, trying to act as though it was their idea to begin with. Those are some of the greatest accolades in politics. It happens all of the time. And so I'm happy that we're in a time. I want to tell everybody here tonight, though, that I want you to remember that this isn't a Democratic thing or a Republican thing, this comprehensive immigration reform. It isn't about Obama, and it isn't about the Tea Party. It's about 11 million people that are undocumented in the United States of America. 1,100 people will be deported today, were deported yesterday, and will be deported tomorrow. Each day we leave the system broken. That means hundreds of children every day are left without a mom or a dad. That's wrong. That's an immoral public policy that we must end in the United States of America. And so we've built people up. I mean, Democrats, we were in charge in 2007 and 2008. We were 250 strong in the House. We controlled the Senate. Did we do immigration reform? No, because we didn't want to expend the political capital for the immigrants. We wanted their votes, but we didn't want to expend any political capital for them. Democrats were in charge in 2009 and 2010, and we had the presidency of the United States, and we were 59 strong in the Senate. Did we do comprehensive immigration reform? No, we didn't. The deportations continued, even while Democrats were in charge of the House and the Senate. So when I hear today, we're going to force the Republicans and the Democrats are all together, I said, that's fine. It would have been really nice if we had gotten together a couple of years ago when we controlled both of the chambers and had the ability, and we didn't have to negotiate. Guess what? What we have to realize now, as Democrats, is that we don't control the House of Representatives. The Republicans are the majority. We had our chance. We need to negotiate with them because we have to stop these deportations.
That's Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He spoke in Hartford at Real Artways last week to a crowd of mostly Hispanic families of several generations. I asked him about the fighting between Democrats and Republicans in Congress and President Obama's response to his push for immigration reform. The congressman read an excerpt from his book. This was from January of 2013 when the president invited members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus to the White House.
At the meeting with the president, Bob Menendez, that's Senator Menendez from New Jersey, Javier Becerra, and I, and the three members of Congress who were most involved in the delicate negotiations to come up with a comprehensive immigration reform bill that could get some Republican support and pass, asked the president to hold off on introducing his own immigration legislation. It seemed ironic after 4 years of pushing and pleading, but now the game had changed. The president's opportunity to be the sole leader on reform had passed. To get it done, we needed to balance some delicate politics in the House and the Senate. We needed to round up votes. Barack Obama, my friend from Chicago, the man I had endorsed before any Latino member of Congress, looked at us like we were crazy. After 4 years of constantly complaining and not exactly being subtle about it, and now you want me to wait, the president said. Well, yes, we did. I have my moments of contention with Barack Obama, but I almost always support him. I frequently disagree with him on one vital issue, but there are a couple of hundred Republican members of Congress who disagree with him on everything. They would vote against sunlight if it was sponsored by Barack Obama. We needed him to be patient so we could get some Republican support. To his credit, even though he complained, he listened to us and waited. But it was that word he used, subtle, that stuck with me. He was right. On immigration, I was never subtle with him. I'm just not very good at subtle. But there's nothing subtle about deportations either. They tear families apart. If you want to stop deportations and help immigrants, sometimes you can't be subtle with powerful people, even a president you want to support. It's much easier to stand up to people in power if you view the ability to confront them as a privilege that shouldn't be wasted. I'm not concerned that the president of the United States might be mad at me. I'm amazed I'm in a position where I can make the president of the United States mad. After all, I'm the Puerto Rican son of a cab driver and a factory worker, a kid who chopped up pig innards and swept the floor of an unsuccessful restaurant, a guy who had to drive a cab on the night shift to make ends meet, and somehow 40 years later, after my dad packed us up and took us on the road, I ended up sitting across the table from the President of the United States negotiating comprehensive immigration reform, and nobody ever stepped in and tapped me on the shoulder to tell me there's been a terrible mistake, that I needed to go back to that apartment in Lincoln Park. San Sebastian, I'm still here. So when people tell me I should be a little nicer or try to get along, I think, why? What do I have to lose? I've reached my dreams. Actually, I've done more than a kid sleeping on a cot in a Chicago apartment could have ever imagined dreaming. So to me, that's what it's about. And sometimes it's not easy. And as you know, there are other parts in the book where Barack Obama calls me out in front of my colleagues. And he says, Luis, you're being unfair to me. You know, you went and got arrested in front of the White House saying that I could stop these deportations. That's not true and that's unfair. And he did that in front of all my colleagues. But you know what? That was nothing compared to being laughed at calling a gringo when I was 15 years old. Somehow I thought that that experience of feeling alone that day had prepared me to feel alone that day in that room. Nobody stood up, but I didn't need that. I was a grown, mature man now. But you know something? We proved to the President of the United States what? That he did have the power. And 2 years after he made that statement to me, he signed an executive order stopping the deportations using his executive authority. And today there are 500,000 Dreamers, young immigrants, who have what? Working documents, Social Security, driver's license, and are free from deportation. So sometimes you have to confront people who say that you can't do it. But I want people to understand. I want people to understand. I endorsed him early in 2008. I campaigned for him hard in 2012. I want everybody to understand that. I want him to go down in history as the man, as the president, who championed immigration rights and brought about comprehensive immigration and allowed 11 million people to come out of the shadows. That's the president. Because if he doesn't go down as that president, he's going to go down in the history book as the president who deported more immigrants than any other president in the history of the United States. I don't think That's what I want for my president, Barack Obama. I want him to be known and remembered as a champion of our community. In order to get that done, sometimes you have to confront people in very powerful positions so that they will do the right thing, both for themselves and for the nation.
I'd like you, Congressman, to just quickly outline what comprehensive immigration reform means to you and what it will take in the current Congress to actually get something done.
Well, look, here's what it's going to take. It's going to take Republicans and Democrats working together. So I went to my friend Paul Ryan. I campaigned as hard as I could to make sure he was never vice president of the United States. I did everything I could. And he did everything I could so I'd be in the minority in the House of Representatives. But after the elections, we went down in the House, Jim, and he said, Luis, I heard you yesterday. I watched you on a cable network station. And you said there were two reasons why Republicans should do this. That is comprehensive immigration reform. Number one, because it's the right thing to do. But number two, so that Democrats won't run the tables on us on Election Day. And he said, Luis, you're Catholic, I'm Catholic. And our faith should not allow us to have a permanent underclass. That's values. Those are the kinds of values you need. And you need to work with people that maybe in every other instance you disagree. But in this instance, we're agreeing on a pathway to justice for 11 million people. So I'm going to work with them. Unfortunately, in Washington, D.C., everybody lauds bipartisanship. Oh, they should just get along and work more. But I rarely see it rewarded or applauded. As a matter of fact, the party structures are there to do one thing, to gain power and then to preserve power. Gain power and preserve power. Don't think the Democratic caucus is there raising money in order to make sure Republicans get to stay in charge. No, they raise money in order to defeat Republicans and make Democrats in charge. But we got to make sure that they take care of us, that they take care of us as they attempt to do that. And sometimes we want to make sure that the priorities are the correct priorities. And Republicans, they have to come. Here's what Republican Party has to recognize. You lost the referendum last November 6th. Your candidate, Mitt Romney, said he was for self-deportation, that he was for show-me-your-paper legislation, SB 1070 in Arizona, that he would veto the DREAM Act. That's what Mitt Romney, and guess what? Barack Obama got 5 million votes than you did. You lost the referendum on immigration. Let's do what the American people voted for last November 6th for comprehensive immigration reform. And so the Republicans have to understand that. Otherwise, here's what's going to happen. The Republican Party is destined to become a party of provinces, of a few states and a few localities. Why? 2,000 Latinos turn 18 every day, and they're all citizens of the United States of America.
Congressman Luis Gutierrez from Illinois. He spoke at Real Artways last week about his new book called Still Dreaming. Coming up, we'll hear more about his political journey and his ideas behind immigration reform. That's right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Dr. Steve Perry's website calls him America's most trusted educator, and he's made a name for himself on television and speaking tours as an advocate for school reform. He's principal of Hartford's Capital Prep Magnet School, and he's also a magnet for controversy for his outspoken views on teacher quality. Perry sits down to talk with us about the state of education in America and Connecticut, and I hope you can join us here on Where We Live. Today we're hearing from Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He was in Hartford last week speaking at Real Artways to a mostly Latino crowd. He took questions from the audience, and the first question in Spanish was about his arrests. Congressman Gutierrez has been arrested multiple times, including this October, for protesting immigration and deportation policies.
These are not the arrests of the civil rights demonstrators. It's not the arrest of a woman being arrested outside of Woodrow Wilson's White House would have encountered in 1917 and 1918. No, it isn't. They brutalized those women for wanting the right to vote. It isn't. It isn't the arrest of a civil rights person during the 1950s or the 1960s. It isn't. There's no dogs being. But it is a symbolism that continues through our history to say that I will be denied my freedom, and I'm ready to be denied my freedom But let me express to you that if I thought going to jail for months or years was going to free 11 million people, I am ready to go to jail as long as possible in order for others to live free in this country.
Hello, sir. What's your name?
I'm State Representative Edwin Vargas, and I'd like to ask the congressman, it seems to me that many of the issues we care about have been held hostage largely by a small group within the Republican Party, a small right-wing extremist group. Do you think, Congressman, that there is a will in the Republican Party to cut their losses and break faith with the right wing, or do you think that they're going to continue to be the tail that wags the dog?
Look, the Republican Party is going to have to decide whether it wants to be a party that's going to have a national positioning across this nation. And I think that as long as they respond to a small group of extremists in their party, they will not achieve that. I think things look better and better every day for Democrats recontrolling the House of Representatives. Now, I'm not ready to risk, because I want everybody to understand something. The moment the Senate adopted comprehensive immigration reform last June, 100,000 people have been deported. The latest study in the Chicago Reader of last week indicates that more people are being deported who have absolutely no criminal record. You know, the Barack Obama administration will tell you, oh, we're deporting, but we're deporting. Listen, deport the gangbanger, the drug dealer, the rapist, the murderer. Nobody wants them in our neighborhood. Let's get rid of them as quickly as possible. But don't deport the mother and the father of Americans. There are 5 million American citizen children whose parents are undocumented. That means every day our government leaves American citizen children without a mom or a dad. That's wrong. We can figure out how we fix our immigration system. You can't say that you support the Senate proposal on immigration reform and then deport the very people who would qualify for the Senate for legalization under the Senate proposal. It's wrong. And if the Republicans don't give us a way out of this in terms of a legislative solution to comprehensive immigration reform, then the President of the United States must seriously consider and implement what he did for the Dreamers, for millions of other undocumented immigrants in this country, until the Congress of the United States act. It's wrong to deport them and separate and destroy these families.
We have time for a few more questions. Hello, sir. What's your name?
My name is Werner Ollanadel. Thank you very much for being here. In Connecticut, we not only passed the driver's license bill, but we also passed the Connecticut Dream Act. Great. Which is something that I'm sure that you're pretty is pretty dear to your heart. You know that you don't have the votes in Congress, and you know how this is so important to the Latino community and to many immigrants from many other groups. What do you have to do to negotiate the appropriate will from the other parties to get to where we need to go? When and how do you
I need you and everybody in this room to continue to challenge the Congress of the United States. Let me just tell you how I feel about this. Look, and for those of you that are legislators in this room, you know this to be true. Nothing is going to happen inside of Washington, D.C., unless there's a persistent and consistent demand from outside of Washington, D.C. And people have to understand that there are consequences to the lack of action. Latinos and immigrants and Asians and people in this country have to be ready to come out. And here's what the Republicans are counting on. That in off-year's election, a lot of Democrats don't vote when there's not a presidential. And Latinos are terrible at not voting historically during off-year presidential election. We got to demonstrate to them, come election, presidential or non-presidential, we're voting. And we're going to make our votes count in this country, number one. And number two, understand that Washington, D.C. is only going to... So a lot of people tell me, John, they go, I'm tired. I'm frustrated. I'm disillusioned. I've given up. I don't think anything's going to happen. And you know what I say? You don't have the right to be tired, frustrated, disillusioned. You don't. 1,100 people were deported today. I want you to look them in the eye and tell them you're too tired.
But give everyone who's listening to you some practical advice in making that message, because as you say, voting is one thing, but voting in a Democratic Congress, you just told us, they didn't get it done. Voting in a Democratic president, he didn't get it done. So voting, let's set that aside. What can you do if you want to make a difference to get the attention of people who can?
Register to vote. It's the simplest thing you can do, the first thing you can do. Register to vote. Nobody in this room that has the ability to vote should be registered to vote, number one. Number one, we need to organize, and we are organizing across this country in different congressional districts where there are Republicans. Can I just say this? I want everybody to understand. There are 40, 45 Republicans ready to vote for comprehensive immigration reform. That's a sea change. I've never seen that many Republicans ready to do it. Many of them, like Paul Ryan, want to do it because it's the right thing to do. You know what? Whether it's the right thing to do or because it's the politically expedient thing to do, we got to get them to do it so that we can fix our broken immigration system. And let me just say this, because I think this is many times lost. Everybody thinks that this is a humanitarian plea exclusively. And in great measure it is for me. But if you do comprehensive immigration reform, guess what happens in America? There are more jobs, not fewer jobs for Americans. The Senate proposal demonstrates that there's a $175 billion surplus if you incorporate them completely into our economy in the first 10 years. They don't cost money. They put money in everybody's pocket in their room through their new tax revenue. That's not me. That's the Congressional Budget Office. Number two, after 20 years, it's $1 trillion. So in America, I'd say, you want to have a vibrant economy? Unleash the entrepreneurial spirit. The entrepreneurial spirit, which is what has made America great. The entrepreneurial spirit of the Italians and the Irish and the Greeks and the Germans. Let the entrepreneurial spirit of the immigrants of today reign in America. And you know what you're going to have? A stronger, more vibrant economy and more money in the coffins. That's what we should be thinking about also, that this is good for our economy. Safety? Safety of our nation? We have 11 million people unaccounted for in this. We don't know who they are. Let them come forward. Give us their fingerprints. Go through a background check. Pay a fine. And incorporate themselves and legalize themselves. And lastly, you don't want people to use a coyote to come to the United States? You don't want them to come here illegally to the United States? Then let's find legal means for people to come to do the work. Because I'm going to tell you something. 2 million people wake up in this country every day to work the fields of this nation. When you go to the produce section of your grocery store, remember, somebody picked that produce, that cabbage, that lettuce, those onions, that garlic. That fine glass of Chardonnay was picked. Those grapes were picked by somebody. Somebody has to. Foreign hands are going to pick our food in foreign countries, or foreign hands are going to pick our food here safely in the United States of America. But let's acknowledge who they are, and let's acknowledge something else. Nobody in this room wakes up in the morning yearning for a job, doing backbreaking, dirty, filthy work in the fields, but they're ready to do it. We should acknowledge them, and we should reward them for being in this country and providing us the food that we each and every day.
We have time for one more question for the congressman, and I think we have the microphone back here.
I'm sorry. Congressman Gutierrez, my name is Maribel La Luz, and I work for the city of Hartford, and I work for Mayor Pedro Segarra, and on behalf of the mayor, who unfortunately could not be here today, I want to welcome you to the city of Hartford.
Thank you.
Your passion is palpable, and it's amazing, and thank you for an amazing experience. The mayor has been very clear on this issue of comprehensive immigration, that it's a civil rights issue, it's a human rights issue. He supported driver's license. For a city that is almost 50% Latino, more than 40% African American, if you have any thoughts of how we can continue to push this issue, mm-hmm. because it does affect us all in one way or the other.
Thank you. Let me try to answer the question this way, because I think it's very important. One of the greatest joys I have from this fight and this struggle is that every member of the Black Caucus has voted consistently for comprehensive immigration reform. And let me tell you why, because many times poor communities, struggling communities are pitted one against the other.
Yes.
And in this case, that is not happening. I think that's something that we should all acknowledge. Number two, before you can have unity, Harold Washington, the mayor, he taught me something. He says, everybody's got a base. He says, if you're a woman, you got women as your base, right? If you're Jewish, you got Jews as your base, right? He says, everybody's got a base. If you're gay, you got gay people as your base. Everybody's got a base. But you know what he said? You have to expand on the base. Expand on the base. But never forget that base, right? Never forget it. Nurture it. Remember it. And I want to say something to everybody in this room. I know this, right? And you know this. This room is a room filled of people from all across Latino America. From all across. I mean, there are African Americans and whites, but I want to talk particularly about the Latinos in this room for just one second. I can remember 20 years ago, there wasn't a lot of unity. Mexicans would all be on that corner holding up that wall, and no, it's true. The Dominicans would all be on that floor with their, you know, merengue, and they'll be over there, right? The Puerto Ricans would have their big Puerto Rican flag, because, you know, we love our Puerto Rican flags, right? Up on here, right? But you know what we've built over the last 20 years? What we've built? Solidarity. We've built a roof to unite each one of the walls. So when the rain comes, when the cuando viene la tormenta, hay algo que nos dé, ¿verdad? Protección. I want to tell you how proud I am of the Latino community for overcoming the differences that we have. I asked my wife one time, I said, honey, there's a difference like how Puerto Ricans treat me and others. And she said, ay, mijo, the Puerto Ricans, they're proud of you. You're one of them. So they're proud of you, right? You're an example that they could be proud of. He said, los mexicanos y los guatemaltecos y los demás, you're their champion. You go fight for their civil rights. There's going to be a difference. But the fact is, 20 years ago, you could not have said that about our Latino community. We're together and stronger than ever before. And so the Republican Party should understand one thing. Whether you're a Latino that was born here as a citizen of the United States and Puerto Rican, or you're a Mexican-American that's been here for generations, or you just got here and got legalized and just became a citizen of the United States, we are all in solidarity with the most vulnerable immigrant among us and are going to be intolerant of any injustice against them. And the Republican Party has got to come to realize that. You want to be a party of the future? Treat us well today. Otherwise, you will be destined for at least the next generation to be a minority party in the United States of America.
That's Congressman and immigration rights advocate Luis Gutierrez speaking with me at Real Art Ways in Hartford last Friday night. His new book is called Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. Thanks to Pedro Bermudez, LB Munoz, Will K. Wilkins, and everyone at Real Art Ways for hosting this event. Our program was produced by senior producer Katie Talarski with help from Tucker Ives. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.